Okay, we're on the second lesson of our study. The first lesson had to do with attitudes. And that is very critical to what we do with what the Holy Word of God reveals. But now we address ourselves to the text themselves as they relate to our topic. Communication. Communication demands that people understand what the other person is talking about. You can talk without communication. Because communication demands understanding what the other person means by the vehicle that they use, that is, of words. There are other vehicles for communication, such as countenance, graphics. But God chose the vehicle of words to convey His will to mankind. And words are of such a nature that they can carry more than one meaning. Certainly more than one meaning to people in different times and different societies. That's even true in our society. And so if we're going to talk about the subject of marriage and divorce and remarriage, it's absolutely essential that we understand the terms that are used in our Bible. As for what men mean by it, how can you find out what men mean by these terms, marriage and divorce?
Look it up in an English dictionary.
Look it up in an English dictionary. That's what a dictionary does. It simply reflects how people today use words. 50 years from now, those definitions may be different, or they may have additional definitions. It's just reflecting the current society. But what we want to know is what these words meant to the people that these letters were written to, or at the time they were spoken by our Lord and by others. And thus we're going to be striving to understand in the text what these words mean. All right, so we have a definition here of marriage. Biblically, marriage is a relationship between a man and a woman. There are various relationships a man and a woman may have. Maybe employer-employee. It may be father and daughter. This is a relationship. This relationship is defined by or entered into by these two things that we have. There is a covenant to enjoy and be committed to the duties of the husband-wife relationship, and then there is the consummation or the finalizing or the ratifying of that covenant in sexual union. Now, how do we arrive at that conclusion? Not by looking at a dictionary. Not by, I think it means. Not by turning to religious papers or commentaries. But by biblical usage. We want to find out the meaning of those words by the way they were used, by looking at the context around the word. And that's what we're going to attempt to do in this lesson. So you see on the lesson, we have to enter marriage is to become ones. Where in the world does that idea come from? Well, let's see if we can ascertain if there's biblical basis for that concept. In Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 2. Let me just ask you a question first. Do you believe this passage is talking about marriage?
Yes, it's talking about marriage,
isn't it? In fact, it's the classic passage that's referred to in the New Testament, Matthew 19. Does the word marriage occur in Deuteronomy 24:2? It doesn't, does it? And yet the verse is discussing marriage. What phrase is used when Moses wrote this 1,500 years before Christ? when he wanted to write something for the people about marriage? What phrase did he use?
Becomes another.
Becomes another man. Becomes another man's. What about the word wife there? It's added. It's in italics. Here's one of the dangers of the English Standard Version. A lot of brethren are using the English Standard Version today, or the New International Version. I'm not saying you can't use them, but they have the word wife in them, and they do not italicize their additions. So if you're reading those versions, I'd strongly suggest that you keep by your side one of the major translations, like the King James, the American Standard, the New American Standard, or the New King James, and compare against those, because they do italicize the words that the translators have added. Now, the word wife is the right idea. It's not become another man's slave. It's not become another man's servant. It is the idea of wife, but Moses didn't write wife. And those people to whom he wrote would understand that phrase is talking about this relationship where a woman became a man's companion by covenant and sexual union. So this is not a phrase we've dug up in some lexicon somewhere, some scholarly work. This right here in the text. All right, look at Ezekiel chapter 16. So Moses wrote about 1450, somewhere in there, B.C. Ezekiel lived around 600. So we're moving down the time scale about 900 years. But isn't it interesting that here's another prophet of God writing to the people of God, and in a figurative way is describing God's relationship to the nation of Israel. And he uses the analogy of marriage. And so in Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 8, what phrase does he use that is the equivalent of marriage? Became mine. You became mine. So how do you know it's marriage? Well, there's a couple ways. One, read the context up above, and he describes a young girl who has been thrown out and left, and he comes along and finds her and takes care of her, and then she reaches an age where she can be married. That's the picture that's being presented, and he took her in, and he married her, and he provided for her and cared for her. But unappreciative of all of that, she went out and began to commit adultery. Verse 20, lest there's any doubt, look at verse 20. You became mine. Verse 20, you took your sons and daughters whom you had borne to me. Obviously, if this is not marriage, then God was in an adulterous or a fornicating relationship with this woman in the analogy. So the analogy is that God married this woman, and they had sons and daughters. And then if you look in verse 32, you adulterous wife who takes strangers instead of her husband. So if anybody asks you, how did you conclude that it's the relationship of marriage in verse 8 that is being used to draw this analogy? Here are a couple verses in the context that make it very clear. And it's not uncommon in the Old Testament for this analogy to be made, as God wanted to teach lessons to Israel. And so you see, though, that instead of saying, we got married, he said, you became mine. In Ezekiel 23, and in verse 4, what phrase is used there? They became mine again. The New King James says, they were mine. And then in verse 5, it says, while she was mine.
How would you paraphrase that? While she was mine. While we were married. That's right. That would probably be the terminology we would use. But you can clearly see in the context that here is a definition of this relationship. In Jeremiah chapter 3, Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 1. What is the phrase that describes the marriage of this woman to somebody else? All right, verse 3. The way this version reads is, she goes from him and belongs to another man. Did you say your version said becomes another man's? Is that New King James? Okay, becomes another man's. Belongs to another man. And so again, what is he talking about? Just goes to work for somebody as an employee? No. Plows in his vineyard as a servant? No. It's the relationship of marriage described under this idea. Look at Romans chapter 7. Verse 3. Romans chapter 7, verse 3. Now this verse is going to be translated different depending on what version you have. I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, and it says, so then, if while her husband is living, she is joined to another man. Anybody have the King James?
Be married to.
But this is not the normal word for married that's used throughout the New Testament. So the King James translators actually translated the idea rather than the word that Paul used. It is the idea of married, but it's not the normal word that's used for married. So the American Standard Version of 1901 and the New American Standard Version says joined to. That doesn't help us a whole lot, does it? Joined to. Susan, New King James have? Be married. It follows the King James. Okay? Are you familiar with Young's literal translation? Okay, Young's literal, it's an old translation. And as the title suggests, he tries to translate literally. It's a good version to compare. It's an old Bible. Most Bible programs have it on it if you have a Bible program. Anyway, Young's literal translation translates, becomes another man. She, in verse 3, while her husband is living, she becomes another man's. And the word that Paul used there is a word that connotes that very idea. And I said here on the lesson, if you have availability to a Greek lexicon, you can go look this up for yourself. Thayer's Greek lexicon says this word means to become a man's. And then he has wife, but that's just part of his comment, to become a man's. But you don't have to depend on Thayer, do you? You can see in all these other verses we've used, that is the idea. Now, why these translations have chosen not to use that when they were translating this verse, when they used it in the Old Testament, I can't tell you. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, I'm not a Greek scholar. But I know that that's the meaning of this phrase here. And so I know that marriage is a relationship in which a man and a woman become one another's. Now you note the next part of our study, when you look at this relationship and what's said about it in the Bible, that fits very well the nature of the case. So we have some verses here. We'll not read all of these.
But let's begin in Deuteronomy 7, verse 3. If you wish further confirmation, and I think it would be effective if you take the time to read these, I put several of them on your lesson because it just serves to reaffirm and confirm that this was common terminology when referring to marriage. In Deuteronomy 7, verse 3, a woman is what? Given and taken. Given and taken. She's given by her parents and taken by the proposed husband. So that's their terminology. Well, obviously, if she's going to become his, that fits, doesn't it? She's given, so now she belongs to him. And so that terminology all goes hand in hand. Look at Genesis chapter 34. We'll skip some of these others. And again, I encourage you to have sitting down doing your Bible reading to read these other verses because they'll simply confirm what we're talking about. Look at Genesis 34. Verse 8. This is when Shechem was trying to persuade Jacob and his sons to let him marry Dinah. Verse 8, Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage." If you have a New American Standard Version, what does the footnote say on in marriage? For a wife. Give him to her for a wife. Intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. Again, you see it going hand in hand with the concept of becoming one another's. Look at Matthew 19:5. The next point on the lesson, Matthew 19, verse 5. We'll not read Genesis because what Jesus does is quote Genesis. You can go there to Genesis 2 and see the same thing. In Genesis chapter, in Matthew 19, verse 5, "For this cause shall a man do what? Leave and cleave," right? Or be joined. The King James, the American Standard, the New American Standard pre-95. It's called the 77 edition. So I'm using the 95 edition. But the pre-95 edition has cleave too. King James, American Standard, NAS 77 has cleave too. So here's what you have. What's done with the girl? She's given and taken. What happens with the man? He leaves and cleaves. So if he cleaves to her and he takes her, who does he belong to and who does she belong to? One another, right? Okay? Any questions about that? Comments? Look at 1 Corinthians 7. Now, Paul is writing about marriage in this chapter. They had written a letter to him, as you see in verse 1, and he's responding to their letter. And the whole chapter is discussing marriage. We're looking down here at verse 2. "Because of immorality or fornications, each man has to do what? To have his own." Now, those of you that have studied for some time can answer this question readily. Is there a different word for wife and woman in the New Testament? No, there is not. Same word. It's translated differently, contextually. So what Paul really wrote was to have your own woman. That may sound kind of crude, doesn't it? But that's what he wrote. Now, he's not talking about shacking up. He's talking about marriage. But that's the terminology that's used. So here, we started way back here in the Old Testament, back in the time of Moses, seeing this kind of terminology and actually insinuated in Genesis 2, leave, cleave. And here we are in New Testament times in the first century, and you still see this kind of concept being used. So to have your own wife, and then the woman is to do what? Have her own husband, have her own man. And again, we might not say that way. We would say, well, because of immoralities, get married. And that would be true, but that's not what he wrote. Anybody here use the English Standard Version? Okay. It's becoming widely used. I just, again, want to point out in this verse, because of immoralities, they will say, well, I'll do that on verse 3, actually verse 3. So we'll look at that now. He says in verse 3, the husband must fulfill his duty to his wife. The English Standard Version talks about rendering conjugal rights. That is the idea, but it is not what he wrote. As far as I can tell, there's no word for conjugal rights in what Paul wrote. So what they've done instead of translating is what? Interpreted. This case, that's good. They're trying to help the English reader. What I want a translator to do is just tell me what the fellow wrote. Let me figure it out. But anyway, so just be aware of that with any version. With any version. I don't care if it's even the King James and American Standard, but the thing about the King James and American Standard, they do it much less than the other later versions. The American Standard probably least of all. The American Standard of 1901. So what he wrote in verse 3 was that he's to fulfill his duty, or some versions say do. Remember what is do? I believe the New King James reads that way. Is that right, Susan, on verse 3? What is due to her? So do, D-U-E, or duty, either one. And so we simply ask you to define do. What is something do or a duty connote?
A responsibility?
Because if I say, here, give me $10. I'm not giving you $10.
What's owed?
Huh? What's owed? Now, if you bought something from me and I say, hey, pay me, give me $10, that's due. When the light bill comes due, you have a duty to pay it, responsibility. And he is talking about conjugal rights, but that's not the word he used. Let's just stay with the word he used and just think how this fits. If she belongs to him and he belongs to her, her body belongs to him and his body belongs to her, then the conjugal rights are owed. It's duty, it's responsibility to render those duties. And it's just interesting to me, as you turn to passage after passage, how instructions and statements fit this concept of becoming one another. That's what this whole section is about, what this relationship is. In verse 5, and we continue to encourage to compare versions. So the New American Standard says, stop depriving one another. And that's not bad. That's a good translation. It's just broader than the King James and American Standard. And if you was to compare the King James and American Standard, instead of saying stop depriving, what term do they use?
Defraud.
What does defrauding suggest to you? A crime? What kind of crime? Sticking a knife in somebody or what?
Misrepresenting.
Huh? Misrepresenting, okay. All of those are good answers. It's think of it this way. If you go to Sears and buy television, you say, I'm going to pay you $50 a month. Comes time for the payment, you don't pay. Next month, you don't pay. You've got their television, but you're not paying. What is that?
Theft.
Huh? That's theft. What'd you say?
Theft.
Theft, right? And it's defrauding. You said you'd pay. You owe this, verse 3, right? That's due. And if you don't pay what's due, that is theft. It was interesting to me when I was restudying this again. One of the places I go to look at for words and what they mean, that's what they actually said. Do not rob each other. That's actually how they termed it. Do not rob each other. But the word defraud captures that idea. Now, the New American Standard and the version that say stop depriving include that, but more. It's not using deceit not to pay. You know, when it comes time for your bill to pay Sears, you say, well, I was just tired that day. I had a headache that day. I was out of checks that day. You make all kinds of excuses. That's the deceit that you're talking about. But if you just say, I'm not going to pay it, that's just outright denial of responsibility. And so either way you want to go, the stop depriving says don't do that. Stop depriving one another. But you can see how this is all based on the concept that there's a relationship between this man and woman where she belongs to him and he belongs to her. You don't have the right to expect somebody to pay you for something that you do not own or does not belong to you. And so you see this concept here. Any comments before we move to this next section? Look, in this class, I'm trying to present not simply what I believe the Bible would teach, but how I got there. So you can examine it. If you see something faulty, something that won't stand, you're not going to offend me to question that. I may have to go home and do some more research, but you ask questions if you see a problem, because I want to learn. And so I'm not an authority. This is the authority. Yes, Jeff?
Got this about this whole subject. I've got this belief, and you know that we talked about it. I believe we have to go back to the attitude section, and this duty has to be surrounded with love on both sides in order for this relationship to be fulfilling to both sides.
That's an excellent comment. I'm glad you mentioned that, Jeff. When I teach on the family, I usually bring that out. I'm glad you said that here today. While this is a duty, anything that's said here has to be governed by love. I'm not talking about affectionate love. I'm talking about the love that cares about the other person and how they feel. And so love would be considered of the other person's feelings, of their circumstances, of their health, and those kind of things. And I think Jeff's point is a good point. And never read this. And people do, and that's what I'm sure Jeff has in mind. People use this like a hammer or like a wedge to beat people over the head with. And if you do, that's shameful. That's not the intent of this. In fact, the command here to render what's due is stated, for example, to the husband, render what's due, not for the husband to tell the wife. That's not what he said. Command your mate to... No. And that's the way people use this. I heard the preacher say, and they beat their mate over the head with it. That is not what this text is saying. And so thank you, Jeff. Good comment.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
Since we use some Old Testament passages, like this other, in King David's case, with the many wives, did he belong to all of them? And they all belong to him only?
No, he belonged to them. That's the idea of marriage. If he was married, that's the idea. Was God pleased with it? No. Did he allow it? Yes. God allowed some things he was not pleased with, just like he allowed them to have a king. But he was never pleased with them having a king, was he? That wasn't his plan. That's a good question, Doug. Unless I'm missing something, yes, when he had these other women, if it's marriage, that's what it is. That presents a problem, does it? How can all these women belong to David? Yeah, it does present a problem. It's not God's plan. That's right. You think of Solomon, all his wives and concubines. You can think of every time in the Bible where a man had more than one wife or anything said about the relationship between the wives, it's one of conflict, isn't it? Remember back with Leah and Rachel, Hannah and Peninnah? And just case after case after case. You can just imagine the arguments in the household. Well, he belongs to me. No, he belongs to me. Wait a minute. So anyway, that wasn't God's plan. Good observation, Doug. All right, two things people must do to complete a marriage. One is to enter into a covenant. Let's go back to Ezekiel 16. Now, we read this a while ago. We saw that it's talking about the relationship of marriage. But let's look at what happened so that these people entered into that kind of relationship. And we asked that question. What transpired between God and Israel before she became his? She became his, end of the verse. But what happened before she became his? Swore and entered into a covenant. He said, I also swore to you and entered into a covenant with you so that you became mine. Just a passing note, but save it for future reference. The little phrase, so that, in the King James, in the New King James, in the American Standard, it's translated, and you became mine. The word and is used with various connotations in the Bible. Sometimes it means because, sometimes it means for, sometimes it means indeed. Sometimes it means with the result that. That's the idea. So that, and the translators captured that idea. They should have just translated and if they want to translate literally, like the King James and American Standard did. But the idea is we entered into a covenant and the result was you became mine. So that you became mine. So a covenant was a condition of this relationship between God and this woman, this relationship of marriage. Look at Genesis 21. This is not talking about marriage. It simply illustrates that in their society, taking an oath, swearing is not talking about cussing, taking an oath, making a promise, is a way that one entered into a covenant. Or covenant is an agreement between two people, a solemn agreement. And so here in Genesis chapter 21,
Verse 22, about that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me, etc. So he said, make an oath, swear to me. Verse 24, Abraham said, I swear it. Okay, now, go down to verse 27. Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. Now, the sheep and oxen weren't the covenant. They were a sign of it. Just like the rainbow is a sign of God's covenant with man. The covenant was an agreement between them that they entered into by oath. Go down, if you will, to verse 31. Therefore, he called that place Beersheba, or well of the oath. That's what that means. Because there the two of them took an oath. So they made a covenant. So when you talk about a man and a woman entering into this relationship, one of the things they do is make an oath to one another. Make a promise, a solemn promise, a commitment. We call them, what?
Vows,
wedding vows. And these vows, by virtue of the nature of them, enter them into a relationship by covenant. Marriage ceremonies have become far too frivolous. It's all pomp and ceremony. But taking those oaths are very important. All right, so you can see there that this idea of covenant and oath and their relationship in that text. We ask you the question, what is a covenant? I don't know if you defined it out of the dictionary or what. There's several definitions. Here's usually formal, solemn, and binding agreement. Another is a written agreement or promise, usually under seal between two or more parties, especially for the performance of some action. And I'm sure you've got the definition maybe that you found somewhere. Now, turn to Exodus 23:32. This is just kind of a little side point, but it has been brought up in previous studies with people on this topic. In a wedding, we often have witnesses. And sometimes people have asked the question, well, are witnesses necessary for there to be a covenant? If there are no witnesses, is there a covenant? Could a man and a woman out alone without any witnesses covenant to be husband and wife? Look at Exodus 23:32. Talking about going into the land of promise. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. Making a covenant with their gods, would that require a witness? Could a fellow do that in the darkness of his closet or while he's out under a tree? So I'm going to make this tree my God. Could he? Ronnie? Good point. God made a covenant with Abraham. It was not requisite that there were witnesses. And here is a case where a person will make a covenant with an idol or a false god. There may not be any witnesses, but God knows about the promise that you've made to this idol, this sense of commitment that you've made. Look at 34:12, Exodus 34:12. So if you're asked a question like this, all you have to do is go do some research. Let me see this word, where it's used, and see if that's a requisite part of a covenant, that you have witnesses. It's fine to have witnesses, but that is not an essential part of a covenant. In Exodus chapter 34, verse 12, watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, or will become a snare in your midst. Same idea. One more. Look at 1 Samuel 20:16. Now,
Now this is Jonathan and Saul. Jonathan and David, I'm sorry. They're going out into the field, verse 11. Jonathan and David love one another very much, are dear friends. And so they're making this agreement between them. And so look at verse 16. So Jonathan made, now the word covenant's in italic, but that's the idea, with the house of David, saying, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. So here's just Jonathan and David. Sir?
You said 1 Samuel 21?
20, verse 16.
Oh,
I don't know what I said. I know what I meant. Okay, chapter 20, verse 16. All right, let's look at Malachi chapter 2. By the way, that certainly heightens the importance of teaching our young people about this, because they fall in love and maybe someday they say, yes, I'll be your husband, I'll be your wife. And they consummate that agreement in sexual union. Are they married?
Please.
Yes, sir.
Well, to the original marriage. But Adam and Eve were married, there weren't any witnesses to be had other than God.
Okay, good point. No witnesses there, were there? That's correct. Yes, Craig?
While you're on that point, too, you know, these days people are changing up their vows and all kinds of things. And, you know, there's no, you don't necessarily have to say that, you know, until death do us part, or that I'll submit all to you, or any of that. Just because God's law governs the marriage. So when two people come together and they say they're going to be husband and wife, that's the covenant.
Good
and
point.
Whether people witness them saying all these other things doesn't matter. You know, so I've heard some people say, well, I didn't say I was going to, you know, be married until I die. Well, it doesn't matter.
Craig's right. It doesn't matter unless I'm performing the ceremony. If you're not willing to say it, we end the ceremony right there. But that Craig's right. It doesn't have to be those special words that we use. And that's a good point that he makes. All right. And so... Malachi chapter 2, verse 14. These people are crying, verse 13, because the Lord won't accept their worship and bless them. Remember, this is a theocracy where God ruled over them not only spiritually but civilly to bless their nation. And God was not accepting their offering, and He wasn't blessing them as a nation. And they... crying to God, you won't accept our offering, you won't accept our worship. And then verse 14, you say, for what reason? Why, God, won't you accept our worship? It's amazing to me that this concept is one that we can fall into. And, you know, we're talking about the book of Malachi, so we're talking about something 2,400 years ago. And we still have that way of thinking, that I go to worship, I sing and pray, put the money in the plate, take the Lord's Supper, but then go home and mistreat my mate. But that's okay. That's separate. That's different. What have we done to our thinking? So anyway, they're saying, for what reason? Here's God's answer. He said, you have dealt treacherously against your wife. We're going to ask you the question on the lesson. What does treacherously mean?
Violation of trust.
Violation of trust, isn't it? And so, what trust? You entered into this covenant. Like Craig said a while ago, you said you'd be mine and mine alone. You violate that trust. Maybe we didn't say until death do us part, but that needs to be understood, doesn't it? Okay, verse 15. 16. I hate divorce. Very good. And that's a verse to remember. I hate divorce. Okay, that's good. And so he says, you've dealt treacherously, though she's your companion and your wife by covenant. That is, the wife you covenanted with, the woman you made an agreement with. So when people, whether between them or a small number or a large group at a wedding ceremony, when they make that pledge, there is a witness. God. God is a witness. And so he said, she's your wife by covenant. And he said in verse 14, I've been a witness. I know what's going on. My time up?
5 minutes ago.
That was pretty slick. I got another 5 minutes. All right, we'll pick up with Genesis 2:18 through 24.